How's it going, everybody? Welcome to the Dead Jester Productions podcast, episode number 223. I'm your host, Joshua J. Moskers, joined this week by special guest, Christian Carrion, game show contestant. Happy to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're also a podcast host. You got a lot going on. Charity events you work with. Want to tell people
it's a full
little
plate.
Bit about yourself?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, my name is Christian Carrion. I'm a lover slash historian of game shows. I'm the news editor for Buzzer Blog, the most popular game show website in the world, as well as a digital media producer with the National Archives of Game Show History in Rochester. I produce a weekly podcast called Tell Us About Yourself, Conversations with Game Show Contestants, which is, as it says on the tin, every week a conversation with somebody who's appeared on a game show at some point within the last... I've had people that have appeared on shows 50, 60, 70 years ago and having the time of my life. Also have appeared on six game shows myself as a contestant and just all about that entire crazy world of game shows in every possible way. And if five-year-old me could see what I'm doing now with my life, he would never believe it. And I try to remember that every day.
Yeah, I guess the first question is, how do you go about getting on game shows? The only one I'm familiar with in any capacity is Price is Right, but that's because I've made products that have appeared on there. So I
know what have
the
you made?
Other side of things. A company I work with, I didn't make it specifically myself. Let me rephrase that. Sorry. Company I work with, I work on all their marketing. They make furniture and we've gotten some of their furniture on the show. So like desks in particular.
Oh, that's exciting. I manage a hotel here in Pennsylvania, and there's a company around the corner called Swing Kingdom, and they make all kinds of play sets and jungle gyms. And so the owner of that company has gotten to go out to California to set up their jungle gyms to give away on The Price is Right, which is kind of a
nice,
cool way to see that show. But yeah, I mean, to answer your question, again, game shows are something that I have enjoyed my entire life. And this goes back to when I was a toddler, home with my mom. Before I started going to school, I watched TV with her all day. And TV during the 90s, during the day, was either talk shows, soap operas, or game show reruns. And my mom greatly enjoyed the third category there. And I just... watched as many as I could, got to admire the hosts, admire just the way that they're run. And just throughout my life, developing an appreciation, not only for game shows, but through television, for television and broadcasting in general. And so when I turned 18, it was around the time that Bob Barker was retiring. And I just knew that I needed to experience that before he went away, because The Price is Right was a show that had always sort of been kind of top of my mind. It's always been one of my favorite shows, and it's important to my family. And I think even before I came along, it was important to, you know, my dad and his parents and, you know, his grandmother who he used to watch the show with. So it was just a very important thing for me. And that was the first game show I had appeared on. For my birthday, my parents bought me the flight to Los Angeles. I said, you know, all you have to do is get me the flight. I'll take care of the rest. And I slept on the street for 3 days to get into that show. And I was first in line out of about 2,000 people, because the lines were insane since he was retiring and the demand was just so through the roof. And I got called to come on down, and I played the game and I spun the wheel, and I didn't win a whole lot, but yeah, it was fun. And really, it's just a matter of auditioning. I mean, a lot of people don't know that everybody that is in the audience for The Price is Right got interviewed for maybe 30 seconds on the way in. And so that's how they pick their contestants. And you really don't know that you're getting picked until you hear your name on the show. So all those reactions and the screaming and the laughing and the crying, like, that's all real. That's all real stuff that comes out of these people. And I really just auditioned for any other game show I possibly could. I mean, I tried out for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire 7 or 8 times before I finally passed that test and made it on. I had the Craigslist New York search for game show bookmarked, and I would check that every day because that's when, this is back in the day when things like that were advertised, like on Craigslist, like a want ad, you know, and they were looking for people to play game shows and do run throughs and test certain shows kind of before they make the air, and you know go to New York, make $50 for a day. But to me, it was just an opportunity to be in front of all of that. So really just trial and error, just just keep plugging away. And I've auditioned for as many shows as I've been on for, I think for each one, there are maybe three that I've tried out for that I didn't make it, but you learn something every time. It's a fun experience.
Interesting. Yeah. It's weird peeling back the curtain in some aspects on those too, because it's, in most cases, at least, they're designed to be very flashy and colorful and everything like that. And then you see what goes into it, and it's, I don't want to say just thrown together, because that's not accurate, because there's a lot of thought going into it as well. But like, I've seen photos of like the Price is Right set from the background, like the big wheel, and it's not thrown together, but like you just see like the different like little pieces of wood stick, like holding it all together and everything. It's kind of fascinating. Oh, it's
incredible. Yeah, I mean, you could see the carpenter's initials kind of written in Sharpie on some of that stuff, and seeing it in person. And you know, when I do my podcast, I've talked to a lot of people who have been contestants on The Price is Right, and we talk about this experience of going into that show in particular for the first time. I went in 2007, and up until about 2009, 2010, they were using a lot of the original props that were there for the entire 35 years prior. The original, the pricing games, the sets, the displays, all of that is incredibly old. And when I went, being able to see it in person was just so surreal. And everything is so small in person. And it's so small that once you're done with the show and everything is over, you're walking out, you're back on the street, you mentally you look back and it's like, what just happened? Like, it, the suspension of disbelief gets so scrambled up, because it's The Price is Right, it's the show that you've been watching for however long, but it's there in front of you, and it's miniature, and it's surreal, and it's like you can't even believe it's there in front of you, and by the time you do, it's gone. So I think that's part of the magic as well. I mean, there's magic to a lot of it. Being able to experience a lot of these shows, again, kind of from the behind-the-scenes angle, I don't want to say it destroys the illusion, but it definitely lets you know that TV is a lot of smoke and mirrors and confetti and glitter and spray paint and plywood, you know. But to me, I don't know, there's just something romantic about it. I've just always been fascinated with it.
Yeah. No, it is, there is that mysticism involved too, to an extent, where everyone's like, people watch at home. Like, I remember growing up with like my grandmother, she would watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire all the time. And we'd sit there and try and guess the answers and everything like that. And it's like, you're watching it thinking like, wow, that'd be incredible to be there. And I have to imagine it's wildly different in person
as opposed to
home. Because at home, you think like, oh, I'm so smart. In reality, you're sitting there like probably sweating bullets. Like, I don't know, got to figure this out. Like, there's so much more pressure.
Oh, for sure. And I could talk about that as it relates to Millionaire for days, because that's a show that the experience was so different from what it looks like on TV. But it's another one of the things I talk about, that a lot of these games, you know, when you're sitting at home, they're relatively easy. Okay, I was on a show called Match Game in 2019. And it had been on in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, like a classic show. But they redid it with Alec Baldwin on ABC. Yeah. And the game is really simple. You're just filling in the blank. So if the question is strawberry blank, you say shortcake. The celebrity you pick says shortcake. $25,000. It's a scandalous amount of money for a ridiculously low level of involvement. It's an easy game. But when you take that easy sort of concept and you put it on a stage, now you're hearing strawberry blank from Alec Baldwin face to face. He has a microphone in front of you. There are half a dozen celebrities behind him. The lights are shining down on you. There are 200 people in the audience in front of you. You're on camera. Now, suddenly it's not an easy game and you might say something stupid. And so one of the side effects of being able to talk to so many people who have had this sort of contestant experience is this increased sense of empathy for people who get on shows and embarrass themselves. It is very easy to do. The circumstances, the environment in that you're kind of thrust into as a game show contestant is like not conducive to regular life. Like it's TV. You know what I mean? It's like this magical world. And it's very possible that the smartest person in the world will say something dumb. But just developing the understanding of that and realizing, you know, and I realized it myself because I've said my share of dumb things on shows over the years, but just realizing that that is sort of common to that experience.
I mean, even you see it in like such minor comparisons to it. Like, think of like being in school and having to give a presentation, people stumbling over the words, you know, they'd be able to read that fine if they're sitting at their desk to themselves. Then you put them in front of people in general, an audience, and they have stage fright or whatever.
Oh, sure.
Totally understand.
Yeah, that fear of public speaking is like one of the most common fears in the world.
Mm-hmm. A side question, I suppose, to this is, what's your thoughts on like how people view some game shows as being like rigged and staged in a lot of aspects? Like, I mean, it's happened over the years, and then, you know, what was the 21, I think, was the show from like the 50s.
Yeah, the quiz show scandals in the 50s, right?
Yeah.
Well,
how do you think that's impacted the way people view game shows today?
I think that game shows as a whole have never really gotten the respect that they deserve. You know, you look at a show like The Price is Right. We'll bring that up again. That's been on the air for, you know, half a century. It's still regarded by a lot of people as like a silly little game show. And it is. You know, game shows are silly and fun at the end of the day, but they are worthy of observation and discussion and analysis. And so, I mean, other than the fact that it's illegal to rig a quiz show these days, and if it happened, I think the hammer would come down so quickly. In the immediate following the quiz show scandals of the 50s, there was a massive mistrust of that format. Because what had happened was producers in the 50s sort of realized that the drama can be amped up by increasing the money, increasing the amount of cash that they give away to these contestants. And if you had a contestant that was on week to week, if they had a great personality, they would be appealing to watch and more viewers would tune into the show. And the sponsor, who, you know, shows were always sponsored by one particular company back then, the sponsor would be happy because they were bankrolling all the advertisement on the show, and everybody wins. But it's dishonest, and it's like rigging a carnival game. I mean, it's, you know, it's just it's just scuzzy. And so there was that period of a few years afterward where game shows were sort of tainted in that way. A lot of people, you know, mistrusted it. I think that, you know, the president of the United States, Eisenhower, came out and said this is a terrible thing to do to the American people. But they got their trust back, and I think that it's due in no small part to the efforts of the producers to make shows that are on the up and up, and to you know, create formats that are engaging, whether you're giving away $1,000 or $10. I mean, you know, if you look at a show like Concentration back in the day, you could win a game of Concentration and walk away with a set of tires and a box of pasta, and that would be what you won. But the game itself was so engaging and so much fun to watch that the show was on originally for almost two decades. You know, so just a roundabout way of saying, I think that I would understand the skepticism if we were a few decades in the past, but I think that game shows themselves have come such a long way since then and have done such a good job altogether of being transparent, and just being sort of a safe space where rules can sort of reign supreme. You know what I mean? It's, you know, they do a really good job of keeping everything honest.
Yeah. You familiar, you probably are, with Michael Larson, game show guest.
Yeah, Press Your Luck. Yeah, that was Press Your Luck was one of my favorite shows. Yeah, it was incredible. There was a documentary in 2003 on Game Show Network. It was just a really well-produced, like, two-hour thing on how he did it and why he did it and what happened afterwards. And tragic sort of story, but yeah, I'm fascinated by Michael Larson's story.
Yeah, I think, didn't he get caught up in a couple of other scandals as well?
Yeah, I like think afterwards. Well, and you know, it happens to a lot of people who experience that sort of sudden windfall from a game show. You know, you're chasing that high. You want to do that again. And I think that was his case as well. He entered into a couple kind of get rich quick things, a radio contest where he took out like $30,000 in singles. And if you had matched the serial number that the radio station had, you won something. And he got robbed. It all got like pulled out of his house. Yeah, and that's another like I'm really glad that I'm able to talk to these people who have had this experience, because I think that if a regular sort of casual viewer were to watch a game show, it does look very ephemeral. It does look very, you know, it's fluff. But mm-hmm. to be able to sit down for an hour with somebody who, for example, I talked to a guy named Tom McKee, who back in the 80s broke the record not only for the most games won by a contestant on a game show, but like the highest cash total. He won like $300,000, like 9 cars. being able to talk to somebody like that and just learning their story and seeing that there are three dimensions to these people who look mm-hmm. very two-dimensional in that sort of window of fame that they get on a game show has been super gratifying and just super interesting. Just learning about people is why I like to do this thing, which I'm sure I have in common with you as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've mentioned it quite a bit on the podcast. The reason I've done this show is because I get to meet so many people and talk to them and learn their stories and get that different perspective on things. You know, in a lot of cases, fields or area of expertise that I would never have even thought of diving into in any capacity. But it always ends up being a really interesting conversation. So yeah, like you said, meeting the people is super cool, super interesting, super privileged to be able to do it.
Sure. And if you don't mind me asking you a question just of a fellow sure. podcaster, because I heard your episode number, you've done significantly more episodes than I have.
Outside of this show, I've probably done about 1,000 episodes.
Oh, God bless you. Wonderful. We're up to episode 70 of this current one, and I've done 90 of a previous. So I'm altogether lifetime, maybe about, 160 or so? But mm-hmm. yeah, but you know, you've done a lot. What does the experience of being able to talk to people like this bring to you in your daily life? How has it affected you? How has it affected the way you go about social interactions? I imagine the way that you deal with people on the daily has improved a bit from the time, you know, before you were doing podcasts, which was sort of my experience.
Sure. It's been, I guess I'll loop in all three podcasts, because like originally the first two podcasts I did, one, I was a co-host. I wasn't in charge of it. So I was in the seat of, I get to show up, talk, and that's it. I don't have to worry about editing or anything, which was actually super nice in hindsight. Now that I know the other side of it, it's like, ooh. But I was hosted, and I was friends with the people involved. And we didn't have guests on. So there was no comfort zone to escape, right? I was already comfortable talking to these people. We already had that rapport, the back and forth, you know. So it wasn't anything out of the ordinary other than we were recording and putting it out for people to listen to. So
right.
dealing with feedback in almost real time, right? Right. You upload it and you can see YouTube comments rolling in or whatever. You know, in Twitter or whatever, wherever we were seeing them at the time, we were getting actual feedback, which was new. And then I quickly got into YouTube at the time. So dealing with feedback was commonplace then very quickly. But in this show in particular, dealing with basically a new guest every week, I started this up not terribly far off from when I started a sales position as a job. And so doing both of those at the same time really took me out of my comfort zone of having to communicate with people I'd never met before. And I'd had to do that before the sales position, but not in the position of like thoroughly communicating with people. You know, there's a difference between talking to people at school that you haven't met before and going up to someone and trying to sell them on something spontaneously.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And I can imagine that. Yeah, I can imagine that in those two sort of career paths, whether you're talking about mm-hmm. podcasting or sales, there is that common thread in that I think in order to do either of those successfully, there is a degree of familiarity you have to establish very early mm-hmm. on. I feel like, you know, and I'm not a salesperson. I work in hospitality, which involves some sales, but I would never mm-hmm. call myself a professional salesperson. It's a very useful strategy, right? When it comes to interacting with people, I imagine that you get a better response from a prospective client that you establish that bond with very quickly, mm-hmm. As opposed to just kind of walking up and saying your spiel.
Yeah, it's about finding that common ground as quickly as possible. And it's not even about, you know, you said, like, giving the spiel, it's like, it's about listening, right? Like, my manager at the time, she was super helpful, super nice, really a good source of information and helped me learn a lot, was asking questions, but then just listening, as opposed to going in and be like, hey, here's how we can, I sold advertising, so it's not like a physical product. Right. So it was more of a solution for, like, sales for them, right? I'm helping to advertise for them so they can get more sales in. And so it's about asking them questions and seeing, like, okay, this is the problems you're encountering. Here's, you know, options we have that can help in that regard. And more of a consultative approach, as opposed to directly, like, a, when you think sales, you think like used car dealer, right? Where it's like, hey, this is how great it is. You know, you're just really talking yourself up more than anything, convincing people that what you're doing is great, mainly because what they're already there because they need it or they want it, right? As opposed to what I did in advertising sales, where we're the ones doing, you know, I'm walking door to door in town. Like, I'm having to reach out to them to get them interested. It's not the other way around, as is the case in most physical sales.
And then what you're describing as well. Go ahead. Oh, yeah. No, please, after you.
I was going to say, going back to actually answer your question, how it's, like, changed the way I do things. Like, I've gotten out of that sales position because I actually don't like sales. Just not my thing. But that and the podcast, the way it's changed, it's like, I'm definitely a lot more outgoing in general at this point. I don't have a problem communicating with people or approaching strangers and talking to them. And it's helped me, I guess, just get my foot in the door in different aspects of my life. You know, before, like, I deal with a lot of family members with medical issues. And so, beforehand, I probably would have sat there and just listened to what the doctor has to say. Now it's, and I keep in mind, I'm trying to avoid being rude when I do this, but I do go out of my way, like, hey, I need answers. Like, just provide me the information, get this center, like, more managing of what I'm able to receive as far as information and things like that go, like setting up interviews with guests on the podcast or career wise, whatever it was I was doing at the time, you know, right. Just being more assertive in a positive way, not bullying people around. The last thing I want to do is go up to a nurse and be like, hey, I need you to do this, this, and this. You know,
but communicating the importance. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like communicating the importance of the situation in a very direct way. And I think I'm very grateful that I had this experience in terms of podcasting and being able to kind of come home and sharpen those communicative skills. I think that there's a huge difference between being rude and being direct. And one of the things that I've learned, and I don't know if this is common to your experience as well, Josh, but I've learned that the reaction of the person to whom you're being direct doesn't have as much to do with you being direct as it does to do with them. In reality, there's nothing wrong, for example, with coming up to a nurse and saying, hey, I need answers for this thing. You know what I mean? There's a way to ask that communicates the urgency and also isn't rude. And I think towing that line to me is like, it's a challenge for sure. But from a interpersonal standpoint, I get much better results doing what you're describing, just kind of being friendly but direct.
And that's one of the reasons I got out of sales specifically, was it felt more aggressive and pushy because my life depended on it to an extent, like financially, right? It's like,
sure,
if I'm going to make money, I need to convince people to buy this product. And I had disagreements with, you know, my management team on how we went about doing that. Theirs were, hey, sell them on this, like, this is going to help them. Whereas I viewed it as, if it's not going to actively benefit them, I'm not going to try and talk them into it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to sell them on something they're not actively interested in, or, you know, I don't want to, let me clarify this. There were times where I felt like they were telling me to trick the customer into buying something, and that didn't sit well with me.
Oh, sure. Personally.
I'd rather help people than sell them on something.
Like, absolutely. And that method that you described, where, you know, you're kind of finding out what the client is about and narrowing down the solutions to match the problem that they're describing to you, it gives you a chance to convey that sense of care, right? You care about this person and what they're buying and what they're buying it for. And
I think that's where we went in different directions, like the fork in the road. I would take that information and see like, okay, is there a solution for this? Like, how could this work best or whatever? And their solution was, tell them we can solve that problem. You know what I mean? Like it's not about how do we solve this problem? It's no, we have the solution and the solution is us, like paying us. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was already a foregone conclusion for them going into it. No matter what their issue is, we are going to solve it with our advertising products. And that's not how I view things.
Yeah. Right. And I feel the same way because, again, coming from a hospitality background, like I love the hotel that I work for now, but I've worked at other hotels in the past that are terrible. And they know they're terrible. And the people who see the reviews and stay know that they're terrible. But it's almost like to get by, there's this game of like, play stupid. You've never heard this complaint before. Oh, everybody loves this room. And you know they don't. And after a while, that like works on your heart. You know what I mean? It just has to take a little piece out of you every time. Especially as somebody who you know, prioritizes honesty and good communication and being upfront. And yeah, it sucks. It sucks to have to do that, you know, so often.
That's the issue I've run into too, is having elderly family members that I would take care of in like nursing home facilities and you know, end of life care. It's frustrating because on one hand, it's like these people, I really feel like they could be doing a better job. And I try and tell them that. But on the other hand, I don't want to just say that because I also know that they are wildly understaffed and underpaid. And so it's like that. It's a really frustrating scenario where they're working for a for-profit company whose entire goal is to get people in here, make a ton of money off of them and their families to, you know, to quote unquote, take care of them, but then not provide the staff that with what they need to properly take care of their patients, essentially.
Right. And yeah. Prioritizing.
Dealing with the staff there was super difficult, not because of the staff themselves, but just because of the situation that my side of the family was in and with the staff, what position they were in. It's a really annoying situation in business practice, and unfortunately it runs rampant everywhere.
I'm sure you have a few things that you want to ask me, but on the subject of taking care of people with illnesses, that's something that you and I have in common to a certain degree, because I'm taking care of my mother-in-law who has COPD and emphysema, and as somebody who doesn't do it professionally, it can be very draining. It can be very draining on my energy, and I sometimes find myself desperately needing to recharge you know, the type of day that I know you know happens once in a while with somebody who's sick.
Today.
You know, progress isn't like right. Progress is not linear, you know. Yeah. What do you do to prioritize your self-care? Like, what do you do to recharge? How do you come back to that series of problems with the energy to solve them time and time again? Like, what do you do for yourself, and how do you make sure that you have the time to do it?
Kind of to go back and like rephrase like my version of what you said is like, I was fortunate that I have a lot of family members that are in the medical field in some capacity, not necessarily doctors, but they're in the medical field, so they understand medicines and how they work. You know, like I have family members that are chemists, right? And they made, you know, pharmaceutical drugs, like their companies did at least. So they understand it, which is super helpful. The downside being none of them live here. So it's me having to talk to doctors and get all the information and then be like, cool, you've said it. I've written it down. I'm now going to send this off to the people that know what this means. Right. And so it's a lot of that feel and then feeling like I'm just here as like a middleman. I'm basically useless. And so it's super frustrating and draining for me. And to like recharge, I would just come home and, you know, sleep. I would do a lot of working out, which wasn't very productive to put it. Especially at the worst, I would come home and try to work out and my mind would be elsewhere. So I'd be like, all right, let me just take a little bit longer break. And so I'd end up getting very little positive gain out of the workout sessions.
Sure. Because you're already exhausted, I bet.
Yeah. And so it was it's really not the right way I should have gone about it. I probably should have just done, which is what I do now, or do my workouts the first thing in the morning. Which, that's what I should have done, because then it's like out of the way. It's like I don't have the day behind me to reflect on. It's like, let's get this done, and then we'll see what happens after this. Like, there's nothing to focus on other than the workout.
But like, working,
like just having stuff to do. Like, I'm very much one of those people where it's like checklists work for me. Like having organized tasks, even if I'm the one making them. Like, I do that for my work, my actual work. I do that for like the podcast, the brand, everything like that. And it's literally how I play like video games. Like, I've been able to game a bit more lately, which has been nice, because I find it super relaxing generally, unless we're playing. One of the games we've been playing lately is NBA online, NBA 2K24 online. And we're very competitive people and we get worked up a bit.
Sure. But
generally, it's like, let's go into this game and just, it's like mentally putting a grid on the world, just doing area by area and just like mentally like clearing out one space at a time. And it's like creating like organization out of chaos is very calming for me.
Oh, I could understand 100%. And really quick, to go back to what you said about about working out during the day and then realizing you should have done it in the beginning of the day. My wife would tell me, at least you had the thought to go to the gym. Like, at least you had the thought to work out. And that puts you 10 steps ahead of so many people who wish they could and couldn't or don't and decide they don't want to.
I think I talked about it on either the last episode or the episode before, maybe with the guest. Honestly, at a certain point, it all runs together after doing so many episodes. Like, I can't tell what I've talked about, what I have, or when I have. Sure. Like we mentioned, like, if you physically go to a gym, you're more likely to do the workouts because there's already that feeling of guilt or accountability built in, because, like, I'm here, I might as well do it. Otherwise, people are going to see me doing nothing and, you know, whatever. I work out at home. I have, like, all my home equipment here. And I'm only going to expand on it, but for me, it's so much easier having it at home, doing it in the morning. Part of it too is I'll come into the office here and I don't consider it a workout, but I have a bike trainer, stationary trainer. So I set my bike into that and I just ride my bike while I work at my desk. And it's just an easy extra like cardio. And it's not in the way like a workout session would be, you know?
Sure. You just get your steps in.
Essentially. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Love that.
But yeah, no, just setting, like I said, setting checklists for myself is how I keep myself held accountable, and having that sense of management and organization calms me down a lot.
That's good. That's good advice. I need to do that for myself
more often. I think having a lack, this is for me personally, like having a lack of organization makes things a lot more hectic, which is, like I said, what we ran into today, where it's like, oh, my schedule's all over the place now. Everything's been turned upside down. And I messaged you and I was like, we can adjust the time, and then that got messed up. So it's like I panic in those scenarios to an extent where I'm just like, let's make this work.
And I know that feeling.
Yeah. I'm usually like very, very good at like time management. And then when like uncertainty gets thrown into the mix and I don't know when something is going to be done or like happen, that's when I use the word panic. That's not the right word. It just throws me off kilter, I suppose. Where I'm like,
yeah, I get flustered. That's how I think of it.
Yeah, I have to manage my time super well. Like, that's just how I'm built. But going back to the organization side of it, and so not being able to organize it causes me to like, okay, it's me trying to organize everything in my mind all at once, because it's like, all right, well, I had this that needed to be done now. Now this is going to get moved to here. Now I'm like, so I just get overwhelmed mentally trying to reorganize everything in my head all at once, when it's just not how I generally work.
Yeah. I try to leave it all in my head, and time after time, I realize I should have written this down. I should have had this in my calendar. I should have been more proactive in organizing.
I have my calendar. It's when adjusting everything. Cause then it's like, I'm accounting, like today, we were scheduled at 5, then we moved to 3. I counted like, all right, this is when I'm going to be here. This is how long, because like I drive these same roads every single day. And so it's like, I know exactly how long it takes within a couple of minutes. It's like this, I can do this quickly. And then I have 15 minutes of buffer time. so I can get here to here. And, you know, it, I account for all this. But then when the schedule gets changed, it's like, okay, well, I'm not going there now. So how much time does that give me back here? You know, and so it really screws with my head.
Let me ask you, you hear how you just said, you know, we were scheduled at 5 and then we moved to 3 o'clock. Some people would edit that out of their podcast. Do you edit out things like that or do you leave them in?
I usually leave them in. I'm pretty open to it. Like that, one of the things a lot of people do is they'll try and avoid like date ranging their content, specifically podcasts. I feel like a lot of the times, unless they edit or unless they record weekly, edit it and put it out like the next day or whatever, or they do it live. Like a lot of people, like today's April 12th, 2024. People would not include that because they're worried it's going to make it seem dated, you know, and to an extent we avoid that in the sense of talking about current events, you know, like when COVID was a thing, we talked about it because that was all there was to talk about. And we talked about our experiences with it and whatnot. Let me rephrase that. We mentioned the time frame of when it was COVID, but we didn't actively talk about COVID because everyone else was doing it. And I was like, no one wants to come to a podcast and hear the 100th person mention it. They come to the show to get an escape from it.
Right. Oh, that's all there was to talk about. When I got laid off from my hotel job, right when COVID hit, because all the cancellations started rolling in, hospitality was just dead, you know, for the next 2 years.
Yeah.
That was like my opportunity. I said, I'm going to become the broadcaster I've always wanted to be. And I'm going to do it on my own terms. So I took a closet in my apartment. I bought $40 worth of soundproof foam. I bought a microphone on Amazon. I made my own studio and I put my phone number out on Reddit. And I said, if anybody wants to talk to me for as long as they want about whatever they want, call me. And I did 90 episodes of that podcast. And if you listen back to them, there's clearly something more happening than just a conversation, because these are all people that are have either been locked in their houses for 2 months or they work a really stressful job because they're essential workers. And this is their one time to, you know, have a chat that's not work related or COVID related. And, you know, I think even that kind of dates them. Do you know what I mean? When you hear a guest like, oh, thank you so much for reaching out to me. I don't know what I would have done. Like, clearly something was happening in the world around them that was a very special sort of connection. And so in that way, I think it's interesting. It will be interesting in the future to look back on like that COVID era of podcasting where it seems like everybody tried it. Everybody wanted, had their own idea of, you know, what they wanted it to be, what they wanted to sound like, and just the way conversations sort of blossomed and the directions that they took in the context of everything that was kind of happening in the world at that time.
Yeah. I have this practice I do where after a show is ended, like the entire run is ended, I go back and re-listen to it as quickly, like as much of a binge session as I can.
Yeah.
I don't do it immediately. Like after the show's ended, I might wait a year and I'll come back and listen to the entirety of the show and see. The reason I do it is because I want to see how it's developed. And I think doing it is listening to all of them as quickly as possible, it's easier to tell. Like think of like a TV show. Like if you're watching 5 seasons of a show over the course of the actual release schedule, you're not going to notice the changes in it as opposed to binge watching it over a weekend.
You'll notice when it found its feet.
Yeah. Right. And so I do that with the podcasts and stuff I've done, like content, where it's like, all right, let's see how it changed. Like, oh, the audio quality gets better here. You know, this is, you can clearly tell, like, this is the week we bumped it up a tiny bit here or changed this or whatever. And it's like, oh, this, you know, this person, they were going through a rough patch, so they're a lot quieter in this period of time. And going back and re-listening to it is super fascinating. And I think that'll be the case with this show as well. And going back and part of it's funny because we started this show like 2 to 3 months-ish before COVID really hit full stride. I don't remember exactly when the lockdowns and everything started happening, to be honest. I think it was like
March of 20, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were a couple months in. And so going back and re-listening to the beginning of the show, it'll be interesting to see like the first like 10 episodes or so. And then COVID like goes in full swing. And then seeing the long tail of that and hearing the changes over time. One, changes in hosts. You know, I had 2 different hosts when I started. One of them left very quickly. And the other one lasted 100 episodes or so before moving on to different stuff. And so the rotating hosts and the way the content has changed from I guess matured to an extent. Like, we still have ridiculous conversations depending on the guests, but it's become a lot more professional based on, and I think a lot of that has to do with my personal life as far as like how I've managed my career. It's become a lot more professional as well, in sync with the podcast, essentially.
Yeah. And, yeah. You know, I think it's great. It's, you know, I don't know why more people don't recommend things like podcasting to people who need to work on their professional communication. It's such a great way to like sharpen those skills, you know,
especially talking to actual professionals in a field. Like, if,
oh yeah,
I very much change the way I speak on the show, or like the demeanor I have based on the guest. Like, I have you like today, like it's a more relaxed, but it's still professional, right? But we'll have guests that come on that are very loose in the way that they speak. Maybe they're like a musical artist, for example, where it's just very quick, fluid, just off the cuff, you know, just kind of jumping around all over the place. And I match their energy, the way they're speaking. I'm not very methodical at all. It's just, I throw in a lot more like slang, so to speak, as opposed to a more, you know, formal setting where it's
more
thought out. I mean, I enunciate a bit more, you know what I mean? It, so depending on the guest, the episode is wildly different because
100%
try to be a chameleon verbally.
I did 90 episodes of that show where every week I was just talking to a different stranger from around the world, and I would learn what they did for a living, and I wouldn't always have questions about what they did. And some weeks, and I'm sure, you know, I'm sure you've experienced this, some weeks you have to do the heavy lifting. You have to be the one that's going to carry this conversation, you know, because they either don't know how to or don't care to, which is fine. You know, there's no law against not being able to hold your own on a podcast, but some weeks were harder than others. And I feel very grateful that the show that I'm doing now is centered around a very narrow and strong interest that I have. And so every episode, I have no problem just communicating that passion, communicating that wonder, that sense of, you know, I want to know what this person is. I want to know what this person is about. What was your experience like? What happened afterwards? What did this mean for you? You know, I'm very passionate about the subject matter. And so I think that sort of works to my advantage.
Yeah. And like I said, for like professional communication, like as I said, doing a podcast to build up those skills, it can be good, even if you have those people on that are not great communicators as a guest, because learning to communicate in one environment is good if you're only ever going to be in that environment, but that's almost never the case, right?
Right. You got to be adaptable.
So, yeah, exactly. And it's good to have people keep you on your toes as well. My part-time co-host constantly says things, so I'm like, I have no idea how to react to this. I don't know what you want for a response. You know, it's just, so like,
right.
It's super easy, like learning that off-the-cuff skill, you know, the improvisation is super useful in most fields. You don't have to be a salesperson or, you know, a customer service style person to use that skill. I mean,
you don't. Yeah. Communicating. I would say it's like communicating with a purpose and, you know, getting to that, for lack of a better phrase, right? Like getting to the point, like just getting to what it is you want to say and communicating it in a way that's easy to understand, that again establishes that little bit of a bond that you get in that, you know, in the beginning, that sort of enables that person to trust what you're saying. Especially in a conversation-based podcast, like I always found that, you know, without stepping on the guest's toes or making the episode about me, the more that I gave of myself in terms of talking about, you know, my experiences and how they may relate to the experiences of the guests that I'm talking to, me being upfront about who I am and willing to share that kind of stuff makes the guests more willing to share this stuff. And so we'd have these like incredible conversations that, like, I feel like I've known this person for years. I've told them things that only my close friends know, but you develop that sort of social intimacy. And I think not being on video helps as well. I always liked that. And when I started my podcast, like, I wanted it to carry that sort of, there was like a romance associated with like being on the phone back in the day. Mm-hmm. And like being able to have a conversation for, you know, half an hour or an hour with like your girlfriend or your boyfriend or your best friend, whatever, that doesn't really exist anymore. Everything is on Zoom and everything is, you know, with a front facing camera. And there was a bit of like nostalgia that I had for that type of conversation, because I think that it enables people to talk in a way that they might not, they might feel inhibited from talking that way if they were on camera and worried about how they look and, you know, what to do with their hands. And I've always liked this format.
Yeah. And that's like, that is basically exactly why we do audio only. We've had a number of like anniversary style episodes where we've done video, like episode 100, 200, whatever, the year long anniversaries.
Sure.
You know, 1, 2, 3 year anniversary episodes, you know, we've done video for those, but those are, we have guests on that actively are, you know, either want to be on camera or just fine with it. And, but yeah, like I've always maintained, like, I'd rather people be comfortable, you know, I don't want people to be nervous, how they look, you know, mannerisms, things like that. Like I'd rather them just be able to sit there, do whatever, and just be able to talk. It's super accessible.
Yeah. Easier to edit too.
That's also true. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, especially if I need to cut out like a 2 second like bit of dead air or something for whatever reason. It looks so janky when you get to video. It's like I can't cut out the dead air without there being a random cut in the middle of the episode of the video.
Right, right, right. Where the person watching knows something happened.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a really interesting experience. And it's fascinating watching the way different people go about it. I mean, I don't post a lot in podcast subreddits, like very rarely at all. Usually if I'm going to comment, it's a direct message, if anything.
Sure.
But the way different people approach it, where some people go into it saying like, oh, I've got this big idea, I want to do this. Or, hey, I have no idea what I want to do, I just want to talk to people. Some people come in very business oriented, like how do I get sponsors, I want to build this show up, and you know, whatever. And just seeing the way different people go about it, it's very similar to the way people go about, you know, YouTube, TikTok, and everything, you know, any social media style platform.
Oh, the, yeah, the just dipping their toes in the water. Yeah. And that, honestly, when I decided I wanted to start a podcast, this was 4 years ago now, I didn't listen to any other podcast to like hear how other people did it. Like I didn't want to know. Like I had heard other podcasts before I started doing my own, and I didn't really like the vibe of them. They all seemed very like...
It's probably because you're listening to my podcast.
No, never. No, I'm having a wonderful time. No. But like, I
would listen to other stuff. Actually be hilarious if you would like inadvertently had listened to like one of the previous shows. I didn't just got the worst possible vibes from it.
And now it's come full circle. Now I'm on the show. Like,
yeah, this show is just, it was terrible. Terrible. Right. Absolutely
awful host. I could do that.
Yeah, I'm like, man, I could accidentally do better than this.
Right. But like, I didn't listen to anything else because I didn't want anyone's influence. Like I had heard other stuff and it just sounded too like professional. Like I know you're in your house with a microphone. We don't have to pretend that's not what's happening. And so when I did mine, I made this like conscious decision. One, I was like, the first word of every episode is going to be hello. It's going to be them picking up the phone and us talking, and it's going to go wherever it goes. It's going to start at that point. And that's how I wanted to do it. The second thing was like, so that's what I was talking about. So yeah, the first thing was like, right. So the first thing was, I wouldn't edit. I would leave everything in. Like there would be these moments where we would, you know, our words would kind of run into each other. We kind of go, oh no, after you. Like I would leave that in. Other people would edit that out. But to me, that's just part of the organic nature of talking to somebody for the very first time. Like that's not going to go swimmingly every single time. It's going to be a little rough. It's going to, you know what I mean? And I feel like that's where, I'm able to practice that skill of like keeping the ball in the air, you know, keeping the show moving. To me it's honestly a life skill that I think I learned just from watching game shows. There was this thing about Bob Barker in particular where he would have like a clock in his mind. He would know when the show was getting, was going to hit that 44-minute mark, which is an hour show, you know, minus commercials. Mm-hmm. He would just know, like, when that moment was coming. And so throughout the show, he'd know that he had time to play around a little extra with this contestant. He'd had to move this game around really quickly. He had to, you know, make all these concessions and stretch in certain places to get it right at that 44-minute mark. And I've always considered that to be, like, a really valuable life skill. Yeah. Just being able to communicate the thing that you want to communicate in the allotted time, you know, I've just always wanted to embody that skill. And so being able to practice that, I'm just super grateful to be able to do that. Whenever I want.
I totally agree. Like I've never liked the sort of overproduced style of podcasts. And the best way I can explain this is like, the best way to listen to a podcast or to edit a podcast is in a way that people don't realize that you even edited it.
Like, oh, yeah.
I edit my show, every single episode I edit, and every once in a while you will be able to tell that there's a slight edit. I had an issue with the most recent episode where there's no good way to fix it because the audio just cut out. And so I cleaned it up as best I could, but it's just there. It's just one little snippet. It's like, eh, it is what it is. But generally it's like I go through, I clean up the background audio if there's anything there, any remnants or whatever, and I'll adjust the levels, things like that. And if there's something that's glaringly terrible, I fix it. But in general, it's like, I just want to put it out how it is, how it's recorded, because it sounds way more natural to me.
And yeah, it's for sure.
To listen to.
Oh, and there's so much comfort in it. And, you know, that's something I think that has been highlighted because of COVID. There is so much comfort in hearing two people talk who want to not only talk to each other, but listen to each other. Because in day-to-day life, there are very few moments where you're having a conversation with somebody and one of you doesn't want to immediately leave. You know what I mean? Like, there, you know, whether you're talking for 5 seconds or like a minute, there's always an exit. There's always somebody looking to go do the next thing. And so there's a lot of comfort. It's almost like an ASMR kind of quality to hearing people talk that are interested in talking.
I do a lot of writing as well, and that's the thing I interject a lot, is people cutting each other off in dialogue. Like, it's weird to me reading something or watching a show, and it's actually why you see those videos of like sitcoms where they remove the laugh track and it makes it look really awkward. I'm like, yeah, it is awkward because people talk over each other all the time. There is no pausing in between saying something and waiting for you to react. And then you say, it's like, that's not how it works. You're constantly chattering back and forth and talking over each other. It's how people communicate.
Yes, exactly.
it sounds way more natural. It's always weird to me. I've listened to shows where they do that, where they edit it to the point where there is absolutely no talking over one another. And while it sounds cleaner, it's harder for me to listen to because it's kind of jarring almost.
Well, I get it. I get it to a certain degree, because even like in our conversation, like I know I have a feeling, I hope that this will play back really well, this whole thing, because I think we're both kind of into this. But there were moments where I would say something and you were saying something or vice versa. And there was a moment where like, oh, no, after you, go ahead, continue. Yeah. And I think that it takes listening back to it to realize that, oh, that sounds pretty natural. That was a regular thing that happened. That wasn't completely rude. It wasn't a show-stopping mistake. That's how people talk. And I like preserving that, just that natural quality. You know what I mean? If I was, if my podcast was food, it would be like organic tofu. Like, you know what I mean? I just want all the ingredients are on the label. This is where we make it. This is how it's made. If you want to make it, here's the recipe. Just go do it. You know what I mean?
There have definitely been times too where I've edited things because people would be saying something, especially if we have like three people on an episode or four even. There have been times where it's too many people talking over one another and a point gets missed. And I'm like, okay, mute everyone else at this time. And then have it, you know, I do edit around it in some ways because it messes up the entire conversation where the audience won't know what's going on. Because like I can be talking while listening to someone else speak, right? If I'm talking and you talk back to me while I'm speaking, I can still understand what you're saying. Only because I know what I'm saying, right? I already know what my point is. So as I'm speaking, I'm listening to you and I hear your point. The audience is waiting to hear both of our points at once.
Right, right, right. Yeah, that's one of those skills that is just so valuable, just being able to actively listen, you know, and mm-hmm. not just wait for the other person to stop making sounds out of their face so you can say what you want to say. But, yeah. you know, just being able to again, just kind of keep that ball up in the air.
Exactly. This is what I was talking about before we started recording, where I have the topics that we can use the backbone, but then we tend to get in the weeds. It's been like 30 minutes since we talked about anything related to game shows.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, this game show episode is going wonderful so far.
Yeah, no, this is
exactly what I like. I don't get to talk to another podcaster very often, and being able to like compare notes. That would be, I feel like, that would be a great idea for a podcast. Just talk shop with other podcasters in a very like unpretentious way. You know what I mean? Just like compare notes. Like, I hate the sound of my voice. Do you hate the sound of your voice, Josh?
I used to, but I've had to listen to it for tens of thousands of hours, it seems.
So you just get used to it.
I've just grown numb to it, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very self-critical. So I edit my own stuff too, and so I've heard hundreds of hours of me talking, and I can just pick out everything. I can pick out every little nuance and thing that I wish wouldn't happen. I can pick it out. But then I also realize no one else in the universe has ever mentioned anything about these things to me. Maybe they don't exist. Maybe we're just hearing ourselves with our own sort of most critical ear. And this isn't that bad.
one of the things I do in my job now, marketing wise, is I'll put together like advertise, like 45-second, a minute long commercials, essentially. And sometimes, like, think of it this way. I'll give you an example of a specific one where it's an overview of the company, right? It's like, you know, B-roll footage of their staff working on things or whatever. And then there's a voice of like, oh, here at so-and-so place, you know, we do this and this is how we make this. And, you know, this is where we're located, stuff like, you know, typical voiceover. And so what I'll do is I will do the voiceover myself. I'll write a script, do the voiceover, and I'll tell them, hey, this is what it can sound like. This is, you know, what the script would be like over the video. That way they understand what the final product is going to be like, because we've already got the video shot. And then once we do that, I'll go back and I'll present it to them. They'll be like, okay, cool. And I say, all right, now have one of your team members, whether it be the manager, the owner, whoever, and just have them do the voiceover. And typically what I'll do is I'll do like an interview style video where it's just the cameras on them and I'll have the script up and they can read it. And then we do like 2 seconds of them on camera, and then I cut back to the previously shot B-roll footage. And so I have them to do the voiceover. But the amount of hours I've sat listening to myself talk for these temporary voiceover samples is obnoxious, because usually it's in a field I don't actually understand.
Sure.
So it's me saying a bunch of stuff that don't make any sense to me. Like if I'm reading, you know, the names of medicines, for example, I'll sit here and listen to it after the fact while editing and be like, I have no idea what I'm talking about.
It sounds like
someone has taken over my body and it's just saying things.
Right. And I remember having the same experience when I would talk to somebody who, for my podcast, would like have a job in a field that I just had no idea where to even begin talking about it. And somehow, like, I asked questions about it, and I almost feel like a little bit of a fraud. Like, if they ask me one question about anything they said, I'm going to expose myself as a total fraud, because I, you know, I'm talking to this person about theoretical physics, and I have no clue. I would have no idea where to begin. But I feel like in situations like that, I feel like the best course of action is to just kind of lean back, let them explain what they want to explain. If you have a question, fine. If you don't, fine. But, you know, let them convey the information, because if you try to ask a question and it doesn't seem genuine, it's gonna sound silly.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it like if I sat here now and said like bismuth subsalicylate, I screwed it up already. Bismuth subsalicylate relieves diarrhea, traveler's diarrhea, nausea, heartburn, indigestion, gas, or upset stomach. May also be used for purposes not listed in the medication guide. If I sit here and just read that off correctly, I would be like, huh, that sounds professional, but I wouldn't understand any of it.
No, absolutely not.
That's just Pepto-Bismol.
I know it. I am one of the few people in the world who loves the taste of Pepto-Bismol. That doesn't have to be a topic. I'm sure that wasn't on your list,
but I've never taken Pepto-Bismol.
Have you really? Oh, God, it helps, man. It helps.
I will say I'm fortunate in that I rarely get sick. But then outside of that, whenever I do get sick, it's usually just like a common cold, and I just drink a bunch of water and it goes away the next day. And so, like,
water cures everything.
I couldn't tell you the last time I took actual medicine, which is very, I say this to people and they're like, oh, and they look at me like I'm anti-medicine or whatever. And it's like, that's not the case. Like, if I get legitimately sick and need to take care of myself, I'll go to a doctor. It's fine.
But right. You just have a strong immune system. Yeah, God bless you. Good for you.
My girlfriend and her mom are like the opposite, where it's like, oh, I feel a headache might be coming on potentially. I better take medicine. I'm like, oh, geez. It's like, please stop popping pills like they're candy or something, you know?
Why can't everybody be immortal like me? Yeah.
But yeah, going back to topic, it's just, like I said, it's just, you get used to your voice over time. That's one of the things you see a lot with people just starting out on podcasts. Like, what if I don't like the sound of my voice? It's like, you probably won't.
Honestly. Oh, you won't. No, sure you won't.
Yeah, you're probably gonna be like, why does it sound so nasally and awful? It's like, yeah, it's how people talk, believe it or not. You're so used to hearing people out in open air that you don't realize what it sounds like when they're being injected directly into your eardrums. Like, unless you record yourself, you've never heard the way your voice actually sounds, because you're constantly hearing the echo of it in your, it sounds weird, but you're hearing the echo in your skull, right? You're never actually being projected.
And I just feel like because of that tendency to be self-critical that humans have, I feel like you'll never hear what you really truly sound like. Even if you're hearing a recording, you're going to hear it through that filter. I had an art teacher once that said something that blew my mind. He said something like, you're never drawing what you see, only what you think you see. You have never seen yourself. You've never seen the aura that you project out into the world. You've never walked up to you and just seen, you know, what space you take up in the world and how you reflect off the environment around you. He was a very he had a collection of 500 neckties, and he was about 6.5 feet tall, and he used to wear like 20 or 30 rosaries. He looked like the Catholic Mr. T. And he had a big cane and big glasses. I don't know why. I remember him and some of the things he said, like, and things like that. It just, like, stuck in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it makes sense. Like, the only way you've ever seen yourself is in a reflection, right? You've never actually seen yourself. And it's...
Right. That's a trip. Yeah. Yeah.
And there's more to, like, seeing a picture of somebody. Like, people... I don't know if I'll word this correctly, but like people take up space, right? They walk in a room and it's not like physical, like, oh, that is the amount of space that their body takes up. It's like, that's who they are. And it's like, they have like an energy about them. Like, are they very commanding of the space that they're in? Are they very like energetic, or are they just kind of hidden away, very shy, concealed? You know, it translates to, like I said, back to podcasting or, you know, whatever content creation in general. I'm a tall, thin guy, but I feel like if I walk in a room, I can command the space very well, because I can be loud if I want to be. I'm usually fairly quiet because I like to just get through meetings as quickly as possible generally, because I have other things to do. But if I need to, it's like, all right, you know what? I need to put the foot down. Like, this is not working. Like, and gain control over a situation.
It's energy too, right? Because you can... If you are not already that person, you can walk into a room and sort of identify the one person who would be the leader. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's possible to sort of harness that energy and walk into a room and just convey that image of like the person who's going to lead whatever is going to be happening here. Mm-hmm. And it's really important, especially I think from a podcasting standpoint, to like establish that early on. You know what I mean?
Backbone of Silicon Valley when you think about it. Like all these IPs starting up saying like, this is going to change the world. They get the money and they get out. And it turns out, they were just they're very good at pretending like they knew what they were doing.
Oh, for sure. Super passionate. You can not know anything about business, but have the passion for the thing that
especially
you want to do.
Especially in like specific niche fields. Like like IT in general, right? Or like sure. the medical field. Like it's very easy to not be educated on that. Like what percentage of people understand computer programming in any way? Very small amount. What percentage of people understand like actual medical, you know, verbiage and things like that? Not that many, based on the general population, you know? So it's very easy, I think, to go into a meeting with somebody whose sole existence is financial, right? Like they're in this to make money. They're investors, right? And the reason I say this with such confidence is because this is literally the people I deal with on a daily basis. Their sure. whole thing is investing in companies and startups, right? You go into this and it's like, hey, this is how this works. You know, this is how this works. This is why this will work this way. This is why we're doing it this way. Like, trust me, like we've got this figured out. And if you're confident, yeah. they will be like, this guy knows what he's talking about. Let's go for it. And well, in reality, they're just confident. Yeah.
It's the same thing with a game show audition. A lot of people ask me.
I'm so glad you're bringing this back around to what the relevant yeah. topic was.
Hey, it's my pleasure. That's one of the things I get asked all the time because I have been very fortunate. I've been on a lot of game shows. And one of the questions that I get most often is like, how do you do it? How do you get on a game show? What's the secret? How do you do it more than mm-hmm. once? And there isn't really a secret to it. The audition starts like as soon as you walk into the room. Like, yeah. and you know what I mean? Like, you don't turn your energy off or on. Like, that's on 24/7, whether you realize it or not. So some people, you know, just have that ability to convey that energy from the second they walk in the door. It's hard. Yeah. It's hard. I have screwed up my fair share of game show auditions just because I did not have the energy to do it. But being able to convey that confidence and convey, you know, as it relates to like a game show audition, like your knowledge of the game and your knowledge of what's required of you, what's required of a good contestant, the sooner you can convey that, the better. And it doesn't always happen word for word. A lot of the time it happens silently as soon as you walk in. You know, it's like a job interview. I mean, you walk into a job interview and you'll know right away if mm-hmm. the job is or isn't for you. You can identify red flags sort of right away. It's the same sort of principles in action when it comes to like a game show audition.
I think too, like to add on what you're saying, and again, I've never been on a game show, so I could be wrong. But with interviews too, like having that prerequisite like information going into it can help. I don't know how many times like I've interviewed people for positions where they come in and they've applied for the job, but they really didn't look into it very much. They just saw that it was a job that was available, so they applied, right? Sure, whereas sure. whenever I've applied for a job, it's like, all right, let me research the company, you know, see what their big selling point is, you know, what areas they appear to be struggling in. And I do as much research as I can going into it. And then I go into the interview, they ask me their questions, and I say, all right, well, I've got a bunch of questions as well. And I'll ask them, you know, like, what is it you're looking for specifically? You know, what can I bring to the table that would benefit you the most? Like, I have skill sets, you know, how would you use my skill set to, you know, fit into this position well? You know, how is this going to benefit me? Too many people go into it thinking like, I just want to seem like I'm intelligent. You know, sometimes they feel desperate occasionally. And I go into it, I kind of view jobs in general, and maybe I have the wrong mindset to be fair. But to me, it's just a business transaction, right? And it's almost, and I can definitely see it at times. And I some of the people I work with, I know I say this to them and they agree, where it's like a perceived arrogance to a point, because I don't go into it feeling like I owe people something. You know what I mean? A lot of people go into a job and like, oh, it's my job. You know, I owe it to them to do this and that. It's like, no, it's in my mind, I've always viewed it as a business transaction where it's, hey, you pay me and in return, I provide this service to you.
Oh, and that's what it is. And that's what nobody should ever forget that's what it is. Yeah. You and I, you know, my wife has kind of jumped from job to job. Luckily, she has found a little bit of success locally as a professional artist. So she gets to work at Target and do her thing there. But really, her life begins when she clocks out and she gets to come home and work in these commissions and stuff. Yeah. And one of the things that I used to tell her while she was kind of hopping from job to job, trying to figure out what was right for her, is they need you as much as you need them. when you go to work for a job, like for those first 30, 60, 90 days, like that is a mutual thing. Like they are figuring out if you're a good employee for them, you're a good fit, but you're also figuring out if that place is a good fit for you. Like yeah. I got a job while I was laid off a couple years ago at one of the tourist shops over here. I live in Lancaster and the Amish thing. It's just tourism is a huge thing around here. So I was working at one of the
everywhere.
Oh my God. 30% of the traffic around here is horse and buggy.
Yeah, pass them every day on my way to work.
Oh yes. And
horse buggy or bicycles.
Oh, both of them are those annoying little scooters. Anyway, so I was working at this shop as like they wanted a manager that had experience in customer service and could come in and kind of reshape the role to like fit their personality. It turns out they didn't want that, and I left after a few days. But I remember the supervisor training me kind of looked at me skeptically and said, "I don't think you love this job yet. I don't think you love it. I'm not getting the feeling that you love it." And I said, "You're correct. I don't love this job yet. It's been 3 days. I don't know what this place would do with my love if it had it.
Yeah.
What would it do?" And she had no answer because you're not supposed to love. Ew. Why would I love it? I just started here.
Yeah. I'm in an interesting position. Like the full. I work two jobs. I do a full time real job, and then I do freelance stuff on the side. Working with content creators, small businesses for the marketing. And my real job, when I started, I told them, "Hey, I'm going to be here a year, probably, maybe a little bit longer, depending on what happens." I'd already had like family stuff on the side that I was dealing with. So it's like, I was like, yeah, I might, might end up costing me more money to take care of these scenarios as well. But I was like, we're looking at probably about a year. And like, okay, well, maybe that'll change. You'll stay longer. I'm like, it could. Or it could not. Maybe I'll leave sooner. Who knows? And they're like, "Well, we'd like you to stay a year." I'm like, "I will give it a year. I will do my best to give it a year." But I went into it explaining to the terms from my side of things. Like, this is not like the end all be all for me. Like, I will be fully self-employed at some point.
Sure.
Like, I'm not coming into this thinking like I owe you a debt. Like, I need to stay here forever. Like, the end focus is me, right? I mean, in relation to the job, obviously, like I've...
Right.
I value my family more than myself and everything like that, obviously. But like from a business point of view, it's like, this is about me, like working with you, and I maintain that mindset of like, they will come in, like I'll work with them sometimes. And it's, "Hey, we're changing up how we want to do this." And I will tell them, "Okay, but understand, like, I'm not interested in doing that. That's not worth my time." And fortunately, the people I work with are very understanding of, "Oh, like it is give and take," right? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's good.
If I tried to do that at a Walmart, they'd probably fire me.
No, right. And it's funny. There are people who work at places like Walmart and have that kind of loyalty. And lest you think that they care about you as much as you care about them, quit your job and watch how quickly the ad is up for your replacement. It will happen within, you won't have even left the building yet. And people will be applying on Indeed to your position. Like,
they'll,
that's
probably
how
have, applications on standby that they just have.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, right. If they don't already have somebody waiting in the wings to replace you, that's how quickly this machine works. So yeah, like you said, it is super transactional, and never make the mistake that the personal enters into it. The work is work. Yeah.
No, and like I said, like I'm in a position, fortunately, where it's like, no, I put my foot down. Like, this isn't how this is going to go. It's like, you're welcome to do that with somebody else, but I'm not interested in being a part of that.
Yeah. And good. Good.
It is what it is. Yeah. I
now, if I you weren't,
I understand that I'll finish my thought. I understand that I'm in a very privileged position. Like, don't get me wrong. Most people cannot do that, but like, I only do that because I have a side gig, right? If I wasn't doing anything else on the side, I'd be like, all right, I'll probably put my nose to the grindstone, just do what they need me to do. But
sure.
I do a ton of extra work to ensure that I have that ability, because I don't like working for other people. I don't like being told what to do. And so I don't, they have things they want to focus on. I say, all right, this is how it is. And I continuously bring up the fact that I'm like, I don't work for you. I work with you. Like, this is back and forth. Like, I'm Yes, technically I'm an employee, but that's only because that's the way the paperwork says it. At the end of the day, I don't have to show back up. I can leave when I want. You don't own me. And I wish more people had a similar mindset, at least. Maybe not such a reckless one, but you know, a similar mindset of like, I can go out and I can find something else. Like if I work for it, I can find a different job. And again, I realize it's a fairly privileged way to view it, but like, I wish people did have that mindset of not feeling indebted to whatever miserable, you know, employer they have.
If you weren't podcasting, do you think that you socially or from a communication standpoint would have the wherewithal to communicate that mindset as effectively? Like, has having all this practice in relation to talking to people and engaging in conversation and getting your point across, has that helped you be that person at work that will say, I'm not going to do this. This is not worth my time.
I guess so. Like, because I've built up the podcast while working on my freelance business, it's kind of gone hand in hand. And being my own boss and like being in like responsible for all of my own stuff has put me in a position where it's like, I need to learn to put my foot down. Like, I cannot be taken advantage of by people.
Sure.
Because it will cost me money and ruin the livelihood of myself and my family. Like, I have to be able to manage my time well. I have to be able to manage expenses well and, you know, everything else that goes into it. And so,
yeah.
To give some backstory, like, my family moved away when I was right after I graduated high school. I don't know if I was 19 yet or not, but I was either 18 or 19 and they moved away. And I was like, cool, I didn't move with them. I could have, I didn't want to. I was like, I don't really want to live in the middle of Ohio.
Sure.
And then
they
moved like further south. They went through all these different states. I was like, dodged a bullet there, realistically.
Right. Yeah, for
but
sure.
But I was like, all right, I need to sort my shit out. Right. Like, I need to work hard, you know, and I was in a position where like, I had to like bust my ass and really do everything I could to get myself in a position to succeed, because I'd gone to 3 different universities over time. And I was like, this just isn't working out for me. Like, I would much rather take a more entrepreneurial route. And so like, content creation came along. Like, I bought the most, like the cheapest entry level stuff I could, you know, camera wise, microphone wise. And I worked hard, saved up every penny I could, and just sat it to the side until I was able to slowly get better and better equipment. And it's still the same way I operate now. And I recommend this to people, even if it doesn't seem, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Even if it doesn't seem super viable at times, every job I've ever worked at, I've gone out of my way to go to different departments or like areas of that company to learn what it is they do, because I want to have as many possible skills that I possibly can. Even if I don't think I can use it later on, you know, it's just like, I want to know how to do this, because if I get stuck at this company, I want to know how to do everything, because that puts me in the best position to be in charge, make more 100%. Money, be more
successful. Adaptability is such an underrated concept or skill set when it comes to the working world. Being able to fill whatever role at a moment's notice, to me, is just so valuable. And it's it's more realistic in some industries than it is in others.
Yeah.
But that's a super valuable life skill.
That's how I helped. That's led me down different paths as far as like career wise. Like, I got, when I was, like I said, after my parents went away, I was working at a grocery store, and I was just like a stalker. I don't know what you call the positions at this point. I was never given a title, but like, I would stock shelves. Like, I worked in the frozen food department.
You're a team member.
Yeah. Team member, employee, number, whatever. And, I worked hard, and I was very efficient with like inventory and everything like that. And so I'd go from my department, I'd help everyone else out and just get it organized and work with them. And so like, I wasn't a supervisor, but I was like, the management trusted me. He and I got along very well, the actual manager. And one of the supervisors just up and quit one day. It's like, yeah, I'm out, done. And he's like, we don't have anyone to cover tonight. He's like, I'm not available. I have to go to one of the other stores and manage it. I'm like, okay. And so he just threw me in charge. He gave me a crash course in like 20 minutes, left, and then I was just in charge of managing the store for the evening.
I went,
he gave me a crash course. I went home for a few hours because I couldn't work too many hours, and came back, closed up the shop, and just being thrown to the wolves helped get me started in like management, like managing staff. And it was weird because when you think about like later shifts in the day at grocery stores or any retail, it's usually teenagers or college kids getting done with school coming over. And so it was like, I was managing people my own age. It was very odd, but every job after that,
that's like great. You just communicate those qualities.
Yeah. But like that, like going back to like sort of what my original point was, every job after that, I was like, all right, how can I get a step up position wise? And like every single job I applied for was like, this would be a useful skill to have. And so like, I would apply for a position that I wasn't really qualified for, and then learn as quickly as I could on the job, develop that skill, and then use that to get another better position. And, you know, I went from grocery store to working at a university to working in sales. And it's like, all right, take this, like working in sales to marketing, like just marketing in general, like managing advertising and sales and, you know, e-commerce and shit like that. And
yeah,
you know, transition that into the freelance, you know, self-employment side of it. It's like just constantly building up the skill set to the point where I don't have to rely on a company to manage a business. Like I have the skill set, the knowledge to be able to build a business from scratch, manage it and sell it. You know what I mean?
Well, that's the way to do it. It's building it yourself is like, it's that's the way to go. And this is like somewhat related. I was on a show on Game Show Network I was on a game show in 2013 called The Chase. And The Chase was on Game Show Network, and it was a big trivia competition.
I don't remember the...
It's on ABC now, like in primetime on Sundays, but the first couple seasons was on GSN. And I auditioned for the producer of the show. His name was Bob Bowden. I recognized his name because I used to love watching the credits of shows.
I know this is. It's the guy with the beast, they call him.
Yes, right, yeah. Exactly. So Bob Bowden was the producer of The Chase. He loved the UK version. He was in charge of this adaptation, and he had a hand in so many game shows that I loved over the course of the 20 years previous to my meeting him in New York for the audition. So I decided I'm going to be friends with Bob. I'm going to put myself out there. So they flew me to California, did the show. I had a great time. I didn't win, but I just had an incredible time. I got a free trip to Hollywood, and then they invited me back from Connecticut to California because they forgot to get a shot for the end credits. So they gave me the whole trip again just for maybe 45 seconds of filming. And then they sent me home the next day and they gave me the hotel and everything. And I met him one more time and I said, I'm going to keep in touch with you. And he said, please do. And turns out he was a reader of BuzzerBlog, the site that I write for, loved the stuff that we did. And we'll fast forward, 9 or 10 years, Bob Bowden is now opening the National Archives of Game Show History in Rochester, New York. And it's part of this larger museum called the Strong Museum of Play. And that's the largest play-related, toy-related museum in the world. They also have an incredible video game history archive. Mm-hmm. But this game show thing is now going to be part of their collection. And so I felt very lucky that I had kept in touch with him for so long, and I was fortunate enough to get invited to a Zoom meeting with him and some people from the museum talking about how we can use BuzzerBlog to promote what they were doing. And I said, you're doing a great job of talking to the hosts and talking to the people in charge of the shows that worked on them and getting the props and all that and building the exhibits. But there are so many people out there who were contestants on shows, and that's such an important role on game shows. I have journalistic experience. I have podcasting experience. I just spent 2 years talking to complete strangers for 2 hours a week. I could do this for you. Let me do it. I will find the people and I will do my podcast, but I'll talk to game show contestants. And they loved the idea. And I credit that success to having formed that relationship early on with Bob, because I don't think that would have happened otherwise. I don't think he would have been aware of me to the point where they could sign off on that idea.
Yeah. No, like it's one of the coolest parts about doing podcasting in general is like the connections you make as well. Like I, you know, one of the people coming to my wedding I met doing this podcast. It's like, it's bizarre.
That's incredible. Bizarre. Are you getting married soon?
In October, yeah.
Oh, hey, congratulations. That's coming up.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'm very fortunate that I never call her the F word. I call her my ex-girlfriend or girlfriend.
Oh, she, I'm sure she adores that.
Hates it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, she was very good about play. She had ideas of what she wanted to begin with. So like it took like the actual planning process took like a month and a half maybe. So we got engaged in December and we've had everything done for like a month by now. So it literally took like 3 months to get everything taken care of.
Oh, that's excellent. Nice.
Yeah.
Oh man, the less stress you have during that process, the less stress you'll have in married life in general. I'm convinced of it.
That's what she hopes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I got married seven years ago on March 25th, and we invited 30 people to our wedding. It was small and intimate and fun, and we weren't in debt at the end of it. My wedding cost less than my textbook's freshman year of college. I was very, very happy for that.
I'm envious of you.
Oh, it was awesome. It was, every wedding should be that level of stress. It was just so smooth and so fun.
Yeah, I wish we weren't spending anything on it, to be honest. And I've mentioned this to her plenty of times, but she will have the wedding she wants and I will be present.
Are you not reading that off a cue card, are you?
No, I am not reading this off of a quay. Is this quay?
Yeah.
Is this Spanish? What is this? Yeah.
It's Spanish for what card?
Yeah. I'm reading this off of what card? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I give or take, you know, whatever. I'm not big on big gatherings. And we have like roughly 90 people we're inviting. We'll probably get like 70 to show up. I have a lot of older family members that definitely can't make the trip. So like it'll be like 70 people roughly, which is fine. But I just like things to be easy and calm and quiet most of the time. And 70 people in a single environment is not calm and quiet to me.
No, I don't know. I don't know that I could deal with it. And it's so exhausting being the groom or being, you know, I'm sure the bride or the groom and just having to greet everybody and my God, I was exhausted once our wedding was done, even with 30 people. Yeah. I was exhausted.
Yeah. And I keep telling them, like, if there's a soccer match on my team's playing, it's up in the air.
Yeah. 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 I don't blame you. I don't blame you. Gotta prioritize that self-care, man.
It's my big day too.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely it is. Oh man. In my line of work, I see probably about 50 to 60 weddings a year. If maybe even more than that, because there are some weekends where we have, you know, two or three. And yeah, that is, first of all, there's so much money that goes into it. There's so much energy that goes into it. You know, it's dealing with family, which, for the love of God, you know, just whatever that can be.
Everyone has to interject themselves somehow, you know?
Oh yeah. It's everyone's day, but no, it's the bride and the groom. And
it's their big day. So I need to make sure I'm there for them. It's like, it's fine.
Horrible. Yeah. I've seen it play out in so many different ways. But yeah, and like the common joke is that, like, oh, it's, you know, the bride's day, the husband, you know, the groom just kind of follows along. No, that's an incredibly important day. It's one of the most important days of my life when I got married.
It's the beginning of the end, as some people say. I don't say that.
Sometimes. Yeah, no, I think. And I'm glad that sort of sense of humor, I think, is dying out. There's like that boomer humor of like, oh, I hate my wife. My wife is my best friend, man. I would never be able to relate to that.
Yeah, we have a really amicable relationship, you know? It's
That's great. If there's one thing a relationship should be, it's amicable.
Yeah. That's where they use the divorce hearings, right?
Right. Yeah, that's it. Divorce. Yeah. Yeah. We're on speaking terms.
My fiance and I, we have conversations.
That's right.
We can hold discussions.
This was a day. Of all the days, this is one of them.
I'm very, hold on, the writing is scribbled, happy, I think is what that says, in my relationship. Right. Yeah. it's fun. I joke. It's really fun. She's only ever listened to one episode of this show at my behest, we had one particular guest on where after the fact we had her and my co-host, his girlfriend, after that we recorded it, but I never released it. And we're like, listen to this. You need to hear this. Like I was playing snippets of it for her. And
yeah,
after the fact, I forget how long it was between recording and the release. She's like, I had to listen to that episode. She's like, that guy was crazy.
that's a good reaction to get from any podcast episode.
Yeah.
I love that.
That was definitely our most off the rails episode, but I like to throw in random things like what we're doing here, because if I say something nonsensical enough, I'm sure it'll get back to me and I'll know. Yeah. She listened to that episode. It's like, she listens now. Like I'll know. And so I leave breadcrumbs.
That's good. My wife does not listen to anything I make, and I'm okay with that. Her stance on it is that's sort of my space, and I don't need, you know, she doesn't need to enter into it with any judgment that she might have of me or criticism or whatever. She just, that's my space to do my thing, and I'm having fun.
I think she doesn't want to hear my voice any more than she already does.
It's like, yeah, I think already, that might be on my side, too.
She deals with me enough on a daily basis. She doesn't need to hear me and my humor.
That's right.
Even
you need to hear stereo, please.
Yeah. Like, at least she can walk away normally or plug her ears. If she's got headphones on, it's no getting out of it. It's just right there, injected right directly into her mind.
That's right. And that does not make for an amicable relationship.
No, that amounts to a passable relationship at best.
That's right. That's right.
Yes. Oh, man. Anyway, we're well over the normal hour, an hour and a half here. I don't know if there's anything to touch on real quick before we wrapped up.
Nothing other than I had a wonderful time talking to you. Having this type of sprawling, kind of far-reaching conversation, not only does it remind me of
the weeds.
Oh, I love it. I love it. But not only does it remind me of the type of show that I used to do and make me miss it a little bit, but it's to me what this type of broadcasting, this type of podcasting should be. Like this is what this format should do. It should be all over the place, no predictable script, no, you didn't pre-interview me or anything like that. I think this is exactly what podcasting should be. Two people talking and enjoying talking to each other. So I enjoy talking to you. Awesome. I hope you enjoy talking to me, and mission accomplished in that case, right?
Yeah, I will say, I don't do this consciously, but there is something fascinating to me about taking people from all different walks of life and seeing how far you can maneuver the conversation off topic. You know, like we had people on, I'll give one example. It's been so many years at this point that I don't remember her name and I feel bad, but she worked in like the mental wellness field. And we got it to a point where we were having a back and forth discussion about how she would survive the zombie apocalypse. And I thought that was a real win.
That's fantastic. Yeah, getting people to talk about things that they wouldn't talk about otherwise. Like I love, I guess in that same vein, I love talking about, and again,
it's more talking, personable, I feel like.
Oh, for sure. And a lot of my guests, like I don't know them. A couple of them are people that I'm familiar with only because I've been involved in this hobby for a really long time. But the other people are just people that I've seen play a game on TV for a few minutes. So there is no dimension to their character other than what I've seen. So being able to talk to them and sort of flesh them out and realize that they are also a person with a history and with weaknesses and strengths and fears and concerns and desires and all that, you know, it's great to give that third dimension to people in that way.
From a business side of it, like one, I find it super fascinating, which is why I do it. Like it's just entertaining to me. And I think it's entertaining for people to listen to. But even from like a business mindset, it makes them more relatable and people are more likely to trust them if they know who they are as a person. You know what I mean? Where it's
for sure.
If I commit up, like, let's say I have someone on that's like a pharmacist. I don't know why I keep going with medicine metaphors today, but you know, like let's say they work in like the medical field. If I just have them on here and they're just talking about like their product the entire time, it's like, yeah, it's all well and good. It's informative. But it's like, who is this person and why should I actually trust them? If I get them off topic and they're talking about like movies and TV or something completely unrelated to the product, it makes them way more relatable and people are way more likely to trust them as well. And
because they're a real person.
Yeah. Granted, like I'm not going to have someone on this show if I don't trust them to begin with. So I don't have a problem doing it. Like if I can do, I can, and I do research beforehand, even if it doesn't seem like it at times. Like I actually do look into people's backgrounds to an extent. We had a guy that reached out to me. He was a politician that wanted to come on the show, and I was all for it. I was like, this could be hilarious. I have no reason to be interviewing a politician. And it, I looked up who he was and I was like, this is not going to work. Like,
yeah,
he had a criminal history with his, with relation to his political position, right? He's like committed fraud and things. I forget what all the charges were. I'm like,
I just you don't need a platform for that.
I was going to say, like, I don't want to give him a platform because he might like make some weird apology for it or justify it. I'm like, I just don't want that. Like,
yeah.
Regardless of what he actually wanted to talk about, I don't remember exactly what, I don't remember if he gave a specific topic, but I was like, I don't trust you. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
I have a history of not being trustworthy.
Well, that's, so this is an interesting point that you bring up, and maybe this can be in closing because I just realized what time it is and I have dinner to make for a sick mother-in-law.
Yeah, so I'm already starving since I skipped lunch, so I'm fine with whatever.
So you mentioned that you have to trust the guest in order to feel like it will be a conversation that you can, you know, facilitate and will make for a good episode. I commented on your post.
Yeah.
Nobody can really tell who I am from my Reddit profile because my username is just a bunch of numbers. So I just said who I was and we set the thing up. What made you trust me enough to give me an hour and 38 minutes of your time?
Part of it was, I read your comment. I found it interesting. Like, I'm happy to give people like a platform. I think it's super interesting. At the end of the day, I don't have to publish the post or the episode. You know what I mean? So there's no real risk involved for me. Worst case scenario is like, all right, I'll end the call early if the person's insufferable. But yeah, no, to go back to your case in particular, I saw clips of you on like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Like, that was one of the easiest results to find. And there's that. I think you have like a fandom page as well that I was looking over.
Full disclosure, I didn't make that. Somebody made that.
Yeah, I read a Lancaster Online had done an article about you. I read like they're talking about winning on your $5,000 on your sixth game show appearance. I think it was leading into you were going to be appearing on the Match Game, I think, or something.
And yeah, that was the most recent one. It's so funny. What you're describing is exactly what my now wife's parents did before her first date with me. Their only frame of reference was he might be the dating game killer. And all they did was Google me and see me on Millionaire. All right, he's fine.
Well, it's interesting because like, you mentioned like, oh, you wouldn't be able to tell from my name, your Reddit account name, and which is true. And people find it creepy. And to be fair, I also find it creepy how easily accessible information is online. Having a random Reddit name doesn't prevent people from finding who you are. And I know that better than most because my Reddit name is very close to my actual name.
Right.
And like we see it all the time. Like there's a company that I was going to work with until I realized who owned it, but they can literally, you can set up in marketing. Like if you go to a person's website, they can track your data for 2 years. You know, this company in particular would literally go in, track you for 2 years, and they go through your browser history. So they can find out what websites you visited. They find out like your personal information, like, oh, they have this account on this website. This is their full name. And it's creepy. I don't do that. Yeah. I think that's too far. I think it's super invasive.
But oh, like, for sure. Like, but it's all in the fine print. People sign off on stuff like that and don't realize it.
Yeah. But like, I'll go back for sure. Most guests, especially if it's on Reddit, I'll look at their post history because I can get some information about who they are, how they like the way they talk to an extent, especially online, see how they speak. And it's all super informative as an interviewer.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great way to, I'm going to have to start doing that. That's a great idea.
Like I said, like managed chaos. Like I'm super big on organization, so having as much information beforehand is super useful to me. And
yeah,
like I said, sure, it doesn't always come through on the show like so visibly, I guess, even though it's audio only. Like you wouldn't get it just by listening necessarily, because a lot of times it's like I have the topics beforehand. Like the topics I'd written down were game show contestant, like Child's Play charity, the game show show. Like I had a number of things written down, knowing that we probably won't talk about all of them, but I don't want to know everything about a person before I talk to them, because then it becomes boring. If I know,
for sure.
If I know what answer they're going to give for everything, it's not right. Fun.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and again, like talking about this, like this format, that's like what it should be. Like you maintain mm-hmm. a little bit of that surprise so that there are sort of darked out areas of the map that you can unlock in your conversation. You know what I mean? And hearing people get to that point, hearing somebody discover something about someone else is interesting. Like that will always be fun to hear.
It's like I said, it's interesting trying to learn about guests beforehand, but it's also disturbing how easy it is to find information about people.
Oh,
and
agreed.
I don't mention the name of this company. I looked at, they have a website. I don't mention their name to anybody because I don't want people going to their website, because then it's like, oh, I've just given away 2 years of your online history to this company by mentioning their name, because people are going to get curious.
And it's scary how much is out there.
Yeah. And I digress. I've gone on for too long.
No, but I understand what you're saying. Hey, this was really a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I really do appreciate you.
Yeah, for having me. It's nice to sit in the passenger seat for a little while, you know?
Yes. Where can people go to check out your stuff?
So the podcast, again, tell us about yourself, conversations with game show contestants, new episodes every Saturday. That's at buzzerblog.com/tell us. It's also on all the major streaming services, Spotify, Apple, all that stuff. And anything else that you want to know about me, christiancarrion.com is the place to go. And thank you very much. Again, this was just such a pleasure to have a nice chat with a fellow podcaster.
Yeah. And links will be in the description, obviously. You guys can go check it out. Thank you so much. This was a great time. I really appreciate it. Went longer than I expected, but that was fine. We would have been recording 40 minutes from now still had we stuck to the original schedule, but
that's pretty, yeah, we got a good chunk of convo out. I love it.
Yeah. So awesome. Well, thank you so much, man, for coming on. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'll clean this audio up for you and send it over. I don't know if you'll need it, but maybe just in case.
Sounds good. Take care for listening. Cool.